Now, just through a little bit of review, we're in the Gospel of Matthew, and he was a former tax collector, a sinner, an outcast. Jesus brought him in with a bunch of others. And so that message of reaching the outcast keeps coming up over and over again. What we see here in Matthew chapter 4, Jesus is about a year into his ministry. He went throughout all of Galilee, teaching in their synagogues and proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom. Now, when we talk about that region of Galilee, a lot of times when you think about that region, you see this big arid place that's sparsely populated. It's very rural, not so. So in that area, there was probably about 3 to 4 million people in a geographical area about as big from here, follow the Ohio River, up to Parkersburg. What's that, about 70 miles away, right? And then take I-77 down to Charleston and then back to Huntington. That area in that spot of West Virginia, just that little triangle, put 3 to 4 million people in that spot, okay? That's a crowded area. And so Jesus went to where the masses were. There were a lot of people living in that area and a lot of people sick. When you have that many people living on top of each other, you had to be very careful about laws of hygiene because disease could just spread like rampant through the area, or it spread rampantly through the area. And so what Jesus is doing, he's going to this highly populated area and he is healing. Look at this. Every disease and every affliction among the people. Now that is incredible. You think about all the diseases that we have in our world today, multiply that by about 5 of the incurable diseases they had then because they didn't have the medical advances we do. And it's just absolutely mind-boggling how many lives were changed. Perhaps millions of people healed, okay? I mean, Jesus would like heal all the people in this room of all their infirmities, that he would do that before 10 a.m. on a Monday, all right? That's just how busy he is. How many of you ever had a family member or you yourself have traveled more than 2 hours to get some kind of specialized medical care? Raise your hand. Either you or a family member. That's a lot. You know, we've had family members go down to MD Anderson in Houston, gone up to Cleveland Clinic before, to Columbus or something like that. And people come from all over the world, these places, just hoping for a chance to be cured of something that their local doctors can't cure them of. All right. And so what happens is word starts getting out, not only for these 3 to 4 million people, but people throughout all the region are coming to have their one shot at being healed because doctors can't do anything for them. They were like, hey, man, there's this guy up in the region of Galilee. Maybe we can go there. And the reason it was so populated in there is because they had fresh water, fresh fish, and it was arid in many other areas. So they just came to this area in droves trying to find a moment with Jesus. He did so many miracles. The Apostle John writes it this way. He said, there are also many other things that Jesus did. Were every one of them to be written, I suppose that the world itself could not contain the books that would be written. I mean, you imagine if every single one of you had some kind of infirmity, some kind of sickness that couldn't be healed, just your story alone could give a book, right? Can you all just write a story of your life and how maybe a sickness affected that? And but then enter Jesus into your life and something happens there. The whole world can't contain those stories. That's how much, it's mind-boggling to imagine what Jesus did. So here all these people are gathering around and Jesus just calls time out for a moment and he sits down on a mountainside. He said, now I'm going to tell you what the kingdom of God is all about. Do you want to be a part of it? And you can just see how people would say, man, anybody can do miracles like this guy? I'm going to listen to what that guy has to say. And so he preaches Matthew chapter 5, chapter 6, chapter 7. It's like a 45-minute sermon. And when he gets finished, this is how the people reacted. It says, when Jesus finished these sayings, the crowds were astonished at the teaching. And for he was teaching them as one who had authority. The word here, authority, means it was a powerful sermon. And not as their scribes. Now, the scribes were the law clerks of the day. They worked for Pharisees who were business leaders of the day. And then you had rabbis who were law professors, PhDs at that time. They were in charge of the scribes, okay? And so you have all these religious groups who did this teaching on what the Bible said, and they would say, well, you need to look up what this rabbi said, this rabbi said, this rabbi said. And all Jesus does is saying, here's what Moses taught you, and now here's what I'm going to tell you is at the heart of that law. And he didn't refer to a bunch of other rabbis except to say those other rabbis were wrong. And everybody's like, this is the greatest teaching we ever heard in our life. And plus, he's doing the greatest miracles we've ever heard in our lives. So then you turn the page and we go to chapter 8, and it's going to answer two major questions, okay? One of which I'm going to answer tonight at Bible study. I'm going to focus on that. It's what gives Jesus more authority than these other scribes and Pharisees and rabbis? Now, I'm just going to go ahead and give you the answer to the question. It's because he was God. Okay, I'm just giving you the answer to the question. I hope you still come tonight, but that's the main answer. That's what gave him the authority. But there's something else the beginning of this chapter addresses, and it's this. How is Jesus different from the other religious leaders? When everybody's listening to him and they're teaching, and it's not just the miracles, they're just saying, what is the attitude of this Jesus versus the attitude of all the other religious leaders? There's something different about him. And in order for me to do that, I need to just kind of give you a quick just understanding of how Pharisees would pray every morning, how religious leaders, scribes would pray every morning. This is a great prayer. All right, you're just going to love this prayer. Here it is. Every morning they would pray, I thank thee, O Lord, that I was not born a slave, a Gentile, or a woman. Okay? Now, wives, how would you like that? How would you like that, Dez, if Josh woke up every day? Thank you, God, that I'm not like Dez. I mean, how would you, Ed, that, I wouldn't think that would build a marriage or build confidence into you, okay? Thank you, Lord. Can you imagine that? I mean, what a racist, misogynistic prayer, okay? Just for somebody to wake up every time. Can you imagine standing out on the street, a white person saying, thank you that I was not born a black person, especially a black woman. Thank you, Lord. Woo! I mean, we hear that today and they're like, oh my goodness, how could they ever say that? But not only did they say it, they celebrated it. And they looked down on anybody who was born a slave or they were born that way because God wanted them to be a slave. They're less than I am. Anybody was born a Gentile, that means they weren't a Jew. Anything else but Jews. All other races are bad. It was so bad that they would not even drink from a water fountain that a Gentile drank from. Now, I know nothing like that's ever happened in this country. We can't understand, right? Gentiles weren't allowed to go into Jewish restaurants. They didn't eat their food. And women weren't even allowed in church. They would meet, the men would sit down like this section right here, and the women and children would have to sit up in the balcony, and the rabbi would just teach in the synagogues to the people down here, and everybody else just kind of sat on the side. It was endemic in their religious system. That was the Pharisaical values and beliefs. They were racist, thought they were better than everyone else. There's no clearer example of this than in John chapter 8, where Jesus is telling them they need to come to the truth and realize that they're sinners and they need to be saved. And he closes his thoughts with this. Jesus says, you will know the truth and the truth will set you free. Everybody's heard that verse, right? How did they respond to that? Boy, this is priceless. They answered him, we are offspring of Abraham and we have never been enslaved to anyone. How is it that you say you will become free? You see what's at the heart of that? How can you say we need to come to faith when we're Jews? It's all these non-Jews. It's all these blacks and whites and Asians that need to get saved, but we were born with the favor of God upon us. How can you say that about us? We're not like slaves. We were born free men. Man, the audacity. That racism and the misogyny towards women is like they were second-class citizens. But there's something else I want to teach you about them. They were also very merciless toward the sick. And here's why. It's because they believed that if somebody got sick, it was because they had done something wrong. They had sinned. So in other words, like if one of our volleyball girls wakes up in the morning and she's got the flu, they would say, oh God, what did I do wrong? What did I do to deserve this? How is God punishing me? And even the disciples fell into this trap. Because listen to what I'm about to say. I'm about ready to say something really important. I need you to get this. If you are immersed in a culture, you will do things that culture tells you to do and you don't even know you're doing it. You will dress like your culture dresses. You will listen to the music your culture listens to. You will dance like your culture dances. You will eat like your culture eats. And you don't even think about it until you go outside of your culture. And then you get in another culture that doesn't eat, drink, dance like you do. And you will say about that culture, you guys are weird. When really that culture is looking at you and say, no, you're the weirdo. And I hate to tell you this, we're from Wayne County. We are the weirdos. Okay? We're different here, in case you haven't noticed. We have our own way of doing things. And so what is happening here is they were immersed in such a context that even the disciples who were being trained by the rabbi Jesus actually believed that sick people were sick because either they did something or somebody in their family did something wrong. Watch this. They're passing by a man and Jesus sees this guy who's been blind from birth. Watch what the disciples ask. Man, how mean and merciless is this? And they ask, hey, rabbi, Dr. Jesus, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? Now, if you believe, watch this. If you believe that someone is sick as a result of something they've done, do you see how culturally that'll change how you reach out to people? Because ultimately, you know, if I hear that Mikey is sick, then I'm going to say the reason he's sick is because he deserved it, right? And therefore, I'm just going to let him feel that pain like, I hope you learn your lesson, Mikey. Maybe next time you won't get diarrhea, all right? I mean, it's just, that's what we do. We're like, what did I do wrong? How can I fix this? Our culture does this all the time. It imposes belief systems upon us. Here's what I want to ask, even before I move to the next point. I just want you to think about this during the week. What do you do? How do you think? That's a result of what the culture is telling you to do versus what your faith tells you to do. And a lot of times you can mix those two up. What is it that you do? How does you live or think or act or whatever that is there? I just want you to think. Everything you do, like, why am I doing this? That's all I want you to do. I'm just trying to raise awareness. All I want you to do is this. When you do something this week, I want you to ask, why am I doing this? When you put your clothes on in the morning, why am I doing this? When you turn into whatever radio channel you listen to in the morning, why am I doing this? Why? Is it because it's something God is leading you to do? Is it because something your culture has led you to do? And if your culture is led to do it and not God, I'm going to submit to you that maybe you need to reevaluate why you do what you do. Maybe you need to reevaluate why you think what you think. Don't let the world tell you to do. Listen to the leading of God. And so here you have these merciless guys that don't care about the sick, who tell them to stay away, and Jesus is going to invade and attack their racism, their misogyny, their lack of mercy here back to back to back. Now, he's going to first do this with a guy who has leprosy. Now, if you're a little sensitive to the stomach, I'm going to show you a picture right now. I go to mission places in the world where leprosy still exists. You don't see it here in the United States, but I've seen it plenty. My wife's seen this when we went over there. I took her and Jonna and Lucas. They went to Africa with me one time. And it starts out like this. You see the picture on the board, and you'll see some people like that over there. And they just taught me when I go, hey, you need to spot this, and you don't need to get too chummy, okay, because you don't want to contract this. All right. Starts out like that. And then eventually it moves to something like this. You can see the boils on this man's face. Okay. And then while I was in Africa, we visited a slum where people were living, where lepers actually lived. And it moves to looking like this. And what happens is you go numb in your extremities and you just you start doing things that are harm, or you'll hurt your foot or knock your toe off or something like that. Literally, body parts start falling off. It's very contagious, and you just got to watch. And the Bible, because they were living in such a densely populated area, everybody on top of each other, they didn't have the hygienic, they didn't have water systems, they didn't have medical care like we have. They had to make some laws for people so they don't kill off everybody else. And so what they said was, if you were a leper, if you found out, you had to go to one of your local priests because they were educated in recognizing these things. And if you started getting just a little bit of scab, can you imagine, guys, you just break out with a little bit of acne and you're like, they're like, oh, you better go see the preacher. And you come down here to see me. I'm like, you know what? I don't know what that is. We need to see one for the next 7 days. I just want you to go live out in a tent by yourself out White's Creek. Okay. And your family can bring you stuff, but they can't get within 50 yards of you. So they can drop a bucket there and then leave. But you just said, man, what a long 7 days that would be. We're just going to see if this gets worse. And then after 7 days, I would go out to visit you and you would come. And then I would have to go through this ritualistic cleansing process after I see you. But I would look at your skin, and if it's gotten worse, I would say, you know what? You got to stay out here by yourself. Now imagine mom and dads, if your kid contracted or your spouse contracted leprosy. What do you do at that point when you've got other family? Do you leave all of them and go care for them? Because if you go and care for them, once you make contact with a leper, you're not going to be able to be around anybody else. So you're not going to be able to provide for them because you can't work out in the marketplace. So really what you have to do is they're going to have to live out there. Your child's going to have to live by themselves out in the tent, completely outside of town. You're going to have to try to earn a life, or your husband, worse yet, because now nobody's providing for your family. You're doing everything you can to provide for them. You drop off the bucket and then you go back. One, as a parent, that would be difficult. How would it feel to be that person left outside? No hope for recovery. You're just going to stay out there until you die. So Jesus is, he's thinking about a culture that has grown up telling people with leprosy that this is what you have to do. It's from Leviticus 13. It says, "A leprous person who has the disease shall wear torn clothes and let the hair of his head hang loose." That's so everybody can see, there's no doubt, that person has leprosy. "And he shall cover his upper lip," this is so the disease wouldn't spread, because it was an airborne disease, "and cry out, 'Unclean! Unclean!' If anybody gets within 50 yards of you," you have to scream at the top of your voice, "Unclean, unclean," 50 yards, what is it? That's from here all the way to the garage. Man, just what would this do to someone's psyche growing up as a leper? Anytime anybody comes close to you, "Unclean, unclean, stay away from me." Because if you don't do it, they will kill you because you're putting everybody else at risk. And then he continues, "He shall remain unclean as long as he has the disease. He is unclean. He shall live alone, and his dwelling shall be outside the camp." Now, understanding that, what the laws were, here's Jesus. He's healing everything. He just finished his sermon, and he's coming down the mountainside. Picture Matthew chapter 8. Here he comes walking down the hill, and he's got great crowds following him. I mean, you're talking thousands of people. Imagine coming out of a big ball game with 30 or 40,000 people or more, and what it looks like when they're all exiting the stadium at the same time. Here they all come, and watch what happens next. And look, behold, that's why behold's in there. It's like, pay attention. Look, something big's going to happen. "A leper came to him." Now, automatically, what do you see here? You got big crowds around Jesus. Here comes a leper. He's breaking the law. Why is he doing it? This is one chance. "I've heard this guy can heal me. I'm tired of living out here. If they pick up rocks and kill me with stones, better that than this slow, agonizing death. I'm tired of being alone. This is my one shot. I'm hurting. I need the healing touch of Jesus." And so he comes, and what does he do? He kneels before him. And the word here for kneeling is where we get the word, he worships Jesus. Nothing's going to keep him away. He just runs. I mean, I'm sure everybody's like, "Get away, get away." They're all backing around like, "What's going on?" And he falls down at Jesus' feet, and he exclaims this message of faith. He says, "Lord, if you will, you can make me clean." Now, there's two things here that he's acknowledging. One is that Jesus has the power to heal him. But two, he just doesn't know what if he wants to. If Jesus is willing to do so. And so he falls down Jesus' feet, and he doesn't know if healing's coming next or a boulder against his head to kill him. Watch what Jesus does. He stretches out his hand, and he touched him. It's probably the first time this guy's had human touch in months, maybe years. Now, I want to tell you this. Watch. The Bible says, the Old Testament says, that you're not allowed to touch a leper. And if Jesus would have done that, he would have broken the law, and that would have been a sin. So what must have happened as Jesus went to touch him? It's against the law. It's a sin to touch a leper. So what does Jesus do? He heals him, therefore not violating the law. And Jesus says, "I will be clean." And immediately his leprosy was healed. And Jesus said, See that you say nothing to anyone, but go show yourself to the priest and offer the gift that Moses commanded for a proof to them. In other words, I don't want to tell your mommy. I don't want you to tell your daddy. I don't want to tell your wife who left you because you had leprosy. I don't want you to run and find your kids. I don't want you to do anything else. I just want you to do one thing. And you know what that one thing was? Do what the Bible tells you to do. Now, that's powerful. Of all the things that God wanted to celebrate at the time, want to go to synagogue, celebrate, whatever, have a party or whatever, Jesus says, stop. I know all these other things you want to do. Don't you do it. Just do what the Bible tells you to do. Go do it. Man goes. An incredible time demonstrating the humility in that man's heart, his act of desperation, falling before Jesus. And now this story's in Scripture for all of us to see for all eternity. It's an amazing story. But I got to ask you this. How many times do you think that guy, obviously he had faith in God, right? How many times do you think that guy and his family prayed for him to be healed of that leprosy? I want you to think about that. If you wake up one morning, you look in the mirror, uh-oh, that zit's looking a little white and funny. I hope this is not leprosy. Dear God, don't let this be leprosy. You wake up the next day, it's a little bigger. You're like, this isn't just a normal case of teenage zits. Oh, dear God, and you show your mom. Oh, dear, honey, we're going to have to go talk to the priest. And you go to the priest. Hey, priest, look here. 7 days, you're going to have to go sit outside of camp for 7 days. What do you think you're doing for that entire 7 days? Praying. Dear God, heal me. Dear God, heal me. Dear God, heal me. Dear God, heal me. And what happened for 7 days? The answer to that's what? Nothing. God said no. God said no. God said no. God said no. At least not yet. Listen. That leper is at the feet of Jesus, ready to receive a blessing from Jesus, but it would have never happened if he hadn't had maybe 1,000 prayers answered, no, not yet, maybe not ever. It's amazing what God has to do to get us to fall at his knees. But that's what he had done with this leper. The Apostle Paul encountered something like this. Because here's the reality of it, folks. We all know this, right? A lot of times you pray for God to heal you or to fix the situation, and God says what? Usually what does God say? No, at least not now. This happened in the Apostle Paul's life. Everybody thinks, oh, I wish it was like in the New Testament where everybody got healed all the time. It didn't happen all the time. One of the apostles had some kind of infirmity. I don't know what that was. What he called a thorn in the flesh, it was constant aggravation. And he said, 3 times I pleaded with the Lord about this, that it should leave me. God, please heal me of this. I think he was losing his sight. He was going blind. And he was like, man, how can I do ministry if I can't see? But God said to me, Paul says, my grace is sufficient for you, and my power is made perfect in weakness. Now, I don't know about you, but that's not the answer I would want from God. I don't want to hear that your grace is sufficient. I want to hear that your power will heal me. And God says, my power will be made perfect through this sickness. Paul says, therefore, I've prayed and I've prayed and I've asked and I asked when I've stopped, because I'm going to boast all the more gladly of my weaknesses, so that the power of Christ may rest upon me. For the sake of Christ, then, I am content with... Now, this is a hard prayer to pray. For the sake of Christ, then, I am content with weaknesses. This is a word for illnesses. For insults, people picking on me, posting stuff on social media, saying stuff's not true. For hardships, the tough times in life. For persecutions, people coming after me. And calamities, disaster in my life. Everything's a hot mess. And Paul says, for the sake of Christ, then, I'm content. Why am I content with all these things? For when I am weak, then I am strong. You're like, man, that's just counterintuitive. How does that make sense? How does that make me strong? Listen, God's people are strongest when they're on their knees. And if you are anything like me, you do not pray nearly as much when things are going well for you in life. I mean, seriously, how many of us in this room pray more when things are going great than when things are hitting the fan? Anybody? It's true of all of us, man. We go and we fall before God when things are going badly. That's when we cry out, God, just please do something here. And sometimes, more often than not, it's like Paul's situation, and God's saying, I got you exactly where I want you right now, which is saying, God, I need you. God, I'm weak. I am poor in spirit, and I am falling on my knees before you. And if you are willing, I know you can fix this situation, but whether or not you do, I will be content because I want to stay kneeling before your throne. My question before you today is, are you willing to run to the altar? As soon as the sermon was over, he ran to fall before Jesus. I don't need it anymore else. I'm falling before Jesus. And I'm willing to say, God, if you're willing, you can make me clean. God, if you're willing, you can heal this situation. God, if you're willing, you can reach into this situation with my family. If you're willing, but if not, I'll worship you anyway. I'll still stay on my knees. No matter what, we choose to trust God. And the story continues with someone going through a similar situation. It's not affecting them, it's affecting someone in their household. This is a Gentile, a centurion, a member of the Roman army. And he comes forward to Jesus. Here it is again. What does he do? He comes to Jesus. He doesn't wait for Jesus to come to him. He comes to Jesus and he appeals to Jesus. He's in a moment of desperation here. And he says, Lord, my servant, here's a Gentile who has a slave. He says, my servant, we read in the book of Luke that this servant's a little boy. He says, my servant, I got this little boy servant in my home and he's suffering terribly. And he said, and Jesus said to him, well, I'll just come and heal him, which is what the guy was hoping for. But watch what he says. He says, Lord, I'm not worthy to have you come under my roof. Now, what an act of humility. This, watch, listen. It's hard for me to say this as a white person, but I got to put it in terms that you'll understand just the humility in this statement. This would be like a black man in the 60s saying to a white man, I'm not worthy to come into your restaurant. I'm not worthy to drink from the same water fountain you drink from. Why would you say that about? Why would you debase yourself like that? It wasn't because of his race. It's because the authority that he recognized, the spiritual authority that Jesus had. None of us are worthy to have Christ come into our lives. Listen, this is the foundation of the humility that you need to come to Jesus, to have God work in your life, is you first have to recognize, I ain't got nothing to offer you, God. I am not good enough. I don't deserve this. I hear people say all the time, man, I've been faithful in this and that, and I've done this, and I've gone to church, and I've tithed, and I've done this, and God just, God owes me this. He should do this for me. Jesus doesn't work with people like that because that's just very prideful. If you want Jesus to work in your life, what you got to do is you say, Jesus, I don't deserve anything but hellfire and damnation. I'm not a good person. I think about sinful things all the time, even if I don't actually do them. And this is what this centurion is saying is, I'm not worthy to even have a conversation with you. You don't need to come to my house. This is all I'm just asking for. I just want you to say the word. Just say the word, and I know my servant will be healed. For I too am a man under authority. This is a military guy speaking. I've got soldiers under me. And if I say to one, go, he goes. And to another, come, and he comes. And if I say to my servant, do this, then he does it. So he speaks to Jesus and he's like, I know you have the spiritual authority to tell this disease to go away from this little boy in my house. And when Jesus heard this, I love it, he marveled. Now, we can just roll right by that, but man, how awesome does somebody have to be for Jesus to go, now, whoa, that guy's pretty good. I mean, to impress Jesus, that's pretty amazing. I mean, I hope I do one thing in life that Jesus goes, well, that was all right. You know, if I can just get that, I'll be happy. Just like, he wasn't a total screw up today. All right, I'll take that from Jesus. But he looks at this and he marvels. I look at Nick Farrell here right today. Stand up, Nick, all right? Nick is somebody who came to Jesus about a year ago, right? And he was baptized here. And he goes and shares the gospel like crazy with college students. I mean, right after he's saved, before he gets baptized, he's going around and asking people to come to his baptism. He doesn't even know what baptism means, but he's inviting people. Okay, thank you, Nick. You can sit down. Now, let me talk about him. I think Jesus looked at Nick and says, "Whoo, I marvel at him. That's pretty amazing." You know why? Because he went around sharing the gospel with people like crazy as soon as he came to Jesus. He probably shared Jesus with more people in the first month of his salvation than most of you have in the last 5 years. I mean, he was just going around doing it all the time. I mean, just, I'm impressed. I'm sure Jesus is looking at him saying, "Now that's somebody that's truly saved. They really believe it. They're really buying into it." And let me tell you what, a lot of you say, "Man, I don't know. I'm afraid to share the gospel. I'm not sure I know enough to share the gospel." Listen, if you know enough to get saved, you know enough to share the gospel with somebody else. If you have enough information to accept Christ, whatever information you had at that time, that's all the information you need to share. "This is what I was like before Jesus. I trusted him. Now I'm a Christian." Would you like to do the same? That's it. It's not that hard. Well, what about the dinosaurs in Job 41? Don't worry about that. Okay? Say, "Go talk to Isaac McCown. I'm not worried about that right now." All right? Just focus on, listen, just go and share the gospel with people. Just say, "This is me before Jesus. This is me after Jesus. How would you like to join me over here?" It's that simple. Don't make it harder than it needs to be. So Jesus looked at this guy and he's like, "Man, what great faith," that the centurion said. And he marveled and he says to everybody else in the crowd, "Ooh, now watch this. This is a Gentile," that they all thank God that they're not one of those, "who had a slave," that they all thank God they're not one of those. Watch this. And he says, "Truly, I tell you." Now, whenever Jesus says, "Truly, I tell you," what does that mean? Translated, what? You're not going to believe this, but I've been preaching for a year. No one in Israel have I found such faith as this guy. Nobody. And you can just see people going, "What? He's a Roman centurion. He owned slaves. How could Jesus say that about this guy?" And Jesus said, "I tell you," pay attention. When he says, "I tell you," that means listen. You know how when your mom or dad looks at you, usually now, "Listen to me." That's what he's saying here. He's pointing at him. "Listen, many will come from east and west. Many will come from Australia and Asia and Africa and Europe and the Americas," all right? They didn't even know the Americas yet, but Jesus did. "Many are going to come from all over the place. And they're going to recline at the table with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven. They're going to be there and they're going to just be in heaven and enjoying it. While the sons of the kingdom," that is people born Jews, "they will be thrown out into the outer darkness. In that place there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth." Why do you, have you done that lately? Go, "Oh man, you ever do that? Oh man, you ever do that?" Why do you do it? It's regret. You grind your teeth when you're, "Oh man, I wish that wouldn't have happened." And this is what it's saying, for all eternity, there are going to be people who think because they were born Catholic or born Baptist or born Methodist or born whatever we say we're born, and they're going to be on the outside looking in because they never personally expressed faith in Christ Jesus. They never made their faith their own. They never fell down at their own altar and said, "Jesus, come into my life and save me." Their faith is based on when my grandpa was a preacher or my grandma or whatever. Jesus says, "Don't buy into the lie." And to the centurion, Jesus said, "Go, let it be done for you as what? You have believed." This is the key. This is what faith drives you to do. And at that very moment, the servant was healed. Now, we're going to go to a next story. But even before I get there, you're going to be able to guess what Matthew's going to address next. Remember, there's all kinds of miracles going on. But he just picks out three here. Why these three and why in this order? Watch this. What's the prayer that they all prayed every day? "I thank thee that I was not born a slave, a Gentile, or a woman," right? Well, he's already said, "I've never seen greater faith than anybody in this Gentile," and then you hear the slave. What do you think the next healing is going to be? A woman. Almost as if it's to say to these old snobby racist men, "Nah, nah, 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 nah." And here it comes. Jesus goes into Peter, one of the disciples' houses, and there he sees Peter's mother-in-law sick, and she's lying there with a fever. And he goes over and he touches her hand. The fever left her, and she rose and began to serve him. Now, from these three stories, I want you to see why Jesus saves people, why he heals people, why he changes people. Three things. The first thing we saw is the leper, so you can fall at his feet and worship him. And the second is so that you can, so the second two we see, so they can get up and they can serve others and proclaim that faith to others. And that's the same reason for all of us, so we can worship God and serve others, so that we can love God and love others. Those are the greatest commandments, and that's what we see happening here in these healing stories. He healed them not for themselves, but so that they could glorify God and take care of others. And at the heart, I think a lot of times that may be why God holds back his healing hand, is because people are asking for themselves and not for the glory of God and for the sake of others. Watch that, your motive for your prayer, because he says, as your faith is, so it shall be dealt to you. Why are you asking for healing? Why are you asking for this hardship to go away? Why are you praying what you are praying? It's for God's glory, for the sake of others, or for your glory and for your sake alone? Why are you praying what you are praying?